Support for User Defenders is provided by Adobe XD. Adobe XD reimagines how designers create user experiences for websites, mobile, and more. Try it free at userdefenders.com/XD.
How do you be a good ancestor? There's an old joke, you know, that the way to be more successful in life is to choose better parents. It's a joke. It's because it's true and because it's impossible. But it actually works the other way around, which is you can make your descendants more successful by being a better ancestor. And that is a choice that we have. You can't divert the course of the Mississippi River, you know, where it's a mile wide. But you can go up to where it's a tiny little rivulet where it starts up in the Rocky Mountains, and you can divert the Mississippi with a shovel.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview UX superheroes who fight for the users in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to part two of episode 53, where I conclude my deep dive with software alchemist and good ancestor, Alan Cooper. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. If you missed part one, I want to encourage you to check it out and you'll gain context around this conversation. It's not essential, but it's highly recommended. It'll give you a more holistic kind of view and flow of kind of how this conversation went down. And there's a lot of good stuff and challenging things as well. Alan is a good ancestor, and you'll learn more about what that means, especially in part two. We talk also about the future of UX. He's got interesting insights on that. And especially, I think my favorite is what he wants his legacy to be. So I ask him that question in part two here toward the end. But don't fast forward. Don't skip it. There's a lot of good stuff you'll miss if you do. Just lead up to it just like you would a good book. And again, I want to remind you, defenders listening, that this is scared straight style. I have not bleeped out any of the expletives that Alan uses. And again, the reason that I don't do that for the first time ever is because I think that when Alan says something, he means it. And the expletives he uses are really just to show how passionate he is. And so he doesn't waste any words. That's what I'm trying to say. And I just felt like I didn't want to cut into that in this case. So I want to share an iTunes review briefly. Sandy Chu left an inspiring interview for me. It was inspiring to me, but she said that the show is inspiring, insightful, and funny. 5 stars she left that on iTunes. And she said, I started listening when I first started out, and possibly even before I got a job in tech. I love how much it is not only about how designers work, but also their value, personal life, and most importantly, their journey to where they are today. Thanks to this podcast, I get to listen to these amazing people and learn from them. As a new designer myself trying to figure things out, it also gives me a sense of being in the community. I feel I can too, and that is truly powerful. Sandy, thank you for that amazing iTunes review. I'm so thrilled that you are finding inspiration in this show and in the interviews, and that it's even brought you into this field. I just love stories like that. And so thank you for taking the time to do that. And defenders listening, I would be truly honored if you did what Sandy did and leave a rating and review on iTunes. It not only means a ton to me, I read every single one, but it also helps the show. It helps other designers find the content that will help them, just like Sandy, either stay inspired or even transition into this amazing field. So thanks in advance for doing that. You can just search UX on iTunes and you'll find the show at the top there, or you can go to userdefenders.com/review. Yeah, enjoy the conclusion, please, defenders, of this unforgettable conversation with the one and only Alan Cooper. So I'm about to open up a can of worms, and with you answering this, quite possibly a can of whoop butt too. So ready?
Sure. What's the worst that could happen?
Should designers code?
I really don't think that's a relevant question. I mean, that's like saying, should designers water ski? I don't know. If it makes them a better designer, yeah. Yeah, they should all. But should I go up and say, hey, you designer, go water ski. It's good for you. You know, that's like, what the hell? Where does that come from? But in order to be a good designer in the tech field, you have to understand what your boss's motivations are. Okay? And you have to understand what your users' motivations are. And you have to understand the motivations of the people who implement your product. You have to understand what motivates them. So if you get that understanding by coding, go for it. But that's how I got it, you know? But I don't think that coding in and of itself is necessary. Now, everybody then starts throwing in my face this thing about the one-man shop. And to which I say, the one-man shop, I say, do you want to go and get your heart replaced in a one-man operating theater? I don't think so. Because if you're trying to build, you know, some world-class software in a one-man shop, what the hell's wrong with you? It's not a matter of, oh, but I have to do this. It's a matter of who said this is the way to do things? I mean, it's just stupid. So, yeah, okay. So you're stranded on a desert island, and what you have is, you know, is a handful of rubbish and garbage and a volleyball, and what you have to do is somehow find your way back to civilization. So I don't give a shit if you take your tooth out with an ice skate. You know, it's just not a big deal. Okay, but don't tell me this is how businesses are run. It's not. Okay, so if you've got a one-man shop, then I fully expect to see you doing some disruptive stuff, okay? Because if you're a one-man shop and you're talking about whether your hamburger menu should be on the left or the right, and then you have to code up the PHP or the HTML or the CSS by yourself, then what you are is you're a dupe.
I don't want Michael Phelps performing my heart surgery.
Yeah.
I'd rather him load me a binker. Just kidding, I don't do that anymore.
Oh, right. Right. Anybody who says binker doesn't. I don't even know what a binker is, but obviously you do.
So that's an interesting kind of segue into specializing versus generalizing, because that's another kind of, you know, hot topic in our field. Do you have opinions on that? You kind of alluded to it a little bit, I think.
Well, I think that, you know, I bitch all the time about visual design as a ersatz stand-in for interaction design. And some people think that because of that, I'm down-checking visual design. And I'm not. I'm a huge advocate of visual design. And I've seen really good goal-directed visual design, and it is awesome. And it has a huge positive effect on the product. But it's not interaction design. Visual design is not about reconceptualizing electronic health records out of the possession of the health provider to the possession of the health consumer. Okay, that ain't visual design. Okay, and the same thing with user interface design. It's hugely important, vitally important, but it's not the same thing as reconceptualizing what the product does, who it does it for, and why. Which is what interaction design means to me. I mean, your verbiage may vary, but at a certain point, somebody's got to ask those questions. And what happens, I think, is a lot of designers say, well, that's the job of somebody a couple of pay grades higher than me. And to which I say, no, they're not thinking about that shit. You know, people in business are not thinking about users. Whether they're thinking about what user interface they like, what visual design they like, or what concepts they use. They're thinking about how do they make money? How do they meet payroll? They're thinking about different problems.
It seems like a lot of, and this conversation is kind of, you know, organically veered into this about the, there's kind of a, I always thought there was more of a contention between designers and engineers, but I think the real challenge, and I don't want to necessarily say contention, but the real struggle and tug of war is between designers and business people. Like, how do we overcome? Like, how do we kind of get up Hamburger Hill a little more on this one? You know what I mean?
Well, it's not between designers and business people. It's between Let me first off say yes, and thank you for framing it that way, and thank you for going there. And now I'm going to refine the details a little bit, because I think you're really on to something. And so I know as a designer, I start out by saying no, but really what I meant was yes. Is really it's between humans and people who want money. Now, don't get me wrong, I want money. You know, and I don't disrespect people who want money, but I believe as Steve Jobs said, profit is a byproduct of quality.
Mm.
Okay. And what I believe is that my personal goal as a practitioner is always quality. I always opt for quality. Okay. And I have blind faith that if I can achieve quality, I will get profit, as Steve Jobs did. And you can see that because for many, many years, Apple held a massive 3% market share, but relentlessly refused to let go of its insistence on quality, okay? And that's what insistence on quality will get you. It'll get you kicked to the curb until you find the right combination. It was when media went digital, all of a sudden, Apple went from a 3% market share to a whatever its market share is now. It went to a dynastic victory, okay, over multiple product fields. That's because their vision was about product quality and delivering the right product for the people for the right thing. The problem is in 1995, there wasn't a lot of digital music. There weren't a lot of digital photographs. There wasn't a lot of digital communication. You know, not a lot of, there was no social media to speak of. And so that relentless attention on people got lost in the Microsoftian vision of a computer on every desktop. They didn't say a computer in every pocket. And they didn't say a computer for every person. It was corporate speak. And corporations, you know, ruled the computing landscape. And Microsoft dominated with that. And Apple just barely stayed alive. I mean, Jobs had to go and beg Bill Gates to give him money. I mean, can you imagine going to your most despised enemy?
Right. Humbling.
Yeah, not an enemy you respect either.
Right. That was war. It was all out war.
And asking them for money, saying, please, Bill, will you invest in my company because I'm about to go bankrupt? And Bill said, sure, Steve, here. Let me reach in my pocket and give you some spare change. He gave him $100 million, you know, chump change for Gates at the time.
Absolutely.
How did we start on that? I lost the track here.
How can we kind of get business people, more people that are more concerned with business, on board with the vision of creating great products?
You can't. I mean, basically, we have to overturn the dominant paradigm. This is a huge task. And you can see this in the breakdown of our political structure and the tribalism and the dissension that's going on across the country, really across the world, is if your metrics are money, it's called Goodhart's Law. Goodhart's Law says that any metric, if a metric becomes a goal, it becomes gamed and it becomes worthless. Okay, so what you do is if you say the goal is to make money, people will say, well, why don't I, instead of creating quality to make money, why don't I just shortcut the whole thing and make money directly? And the thing is if what you're doing is you're looking just at money, then that shortcutting works. And this is how you get, you know, massive crime, like the world economic collapse in 2008. That was a response to a criminal act of American bankers. And And you see this, across the board. So look at it this way. If what you do is you say, how successful is America doing? Well, let's look at the GDP. Okay, well, if you look at the GDP, you know what was the most wonderful thing that ever happened to the GDP? Was the Santa Rosa fire here a few months ago, where 7,000 houses burned to the ground. Okay, that's really good for the GDP. All of a sudden, the construction business has such a boom around here. And car dealers, all of a sudden, they're selling, because like 10,000 cars burned to the ground. So all of a sudden, they're selling lots and lots of cars. And then they had the Malibu fire a month later. And another, 5,000 structures burned in Southern California. Or, Katrina or any of these giant weather events, the flood in Houston last year.
Right.
Okay. That was really, really good for GDP. Okay. So what happens is you have to say our metrics really getting us where we want to go. And what we do is we look, we let the numbers be proxies for reality, and it leads us into trouble. So look, the map is not the territory. So the GDP is not the United States of America. You can't look at unemployment numbers and get a sense for how well we're doing here in the United States, because those unemployment numbers don't take into the fact that they don't take into consideration the fact that a lot of people have to work two or even three jobs in order to keep their heads above water, to avoid, having to live in a cardboard box down by the river. So the numbers don't reflect reality. So the thing is this the same thing is all pervasive in the tech world. I mean, when I started in the tech world, the great big stodgy old companies, the IBMs and the Xeroxes, the Intel even, which was one of the newcomers, they invented the microprocessor and they didn't think it was a microprocessor. They insisted that it was a device controller. And a lot of really smart people said, no, that's a computer on a chip. That's a general purpose computer. And Intel said, no. And what that did was that created a huge entrepreneurial market gap, and a bunch of people waded into it and created a whole new industry. Okay. The problem is in the World Wide Web did the same thing. It created this huge gap where individuals could walk in and say, well, I can create an entirely new business here that the big guys are not seeing at all. The problem is that back in the day, those companies had, they didn't have the internet. So they didn't have the ability to get hundreds of millions of users within a few years. It took them decades and decades to get millions of users. It was much slower, much more tedious, and they had to build brick by brick an edifice of actual quality. Okay. And so the landscape is very different today, and it is not conducive to entrepreneurial stuff. I mean, right now there's intellectual property litigation is an enormous industry in Silicon Valley. And what that does, what all that intellectual property stuff does, is it gives an enormous amount of money to large companies who cross-license their IP, and it doesn't create opportunities for individual creative inventors. I mean, being able to innovate today is really difficult, because if you do innovate, the big guys will steal it from you and crush you. They will out-lawyer you, or the trolls will come in and just take your money and leave you, wounded in the desert without a horse, So it's because what we do is we don't look at things that are good. We don't look at things that are good for us. We don't look at food that's good for us. We don't look at air that's good for us. We don't look at sustainability. We don't look at what's good for our children. What we do is we say, how much money is this going to make me today? And that's what drives everything. And this is not the tech industry. The tech industry just happens to have, oh, by the way, multiplied all that stuff and accelerated all that stuff. I mean, it's not an accident that it may have been, the Russians who hijacked the 2016 presidential election, but they did it with technology products that were built, right here in Silicon Valley. I mean, we've created these incredibly powerful tools, and we have this philosophy that because the tools have no inherent morality, they will be good, which is a contradiction on the face of it. Number one, the tools in fact do have an inherent morality, and it happens to reflect the inherent morality of people who are not accountable for their actions. I believe that people are inherently good when they're accountable for their actions. But I believe that people are inherently bad when they're not accountable for their actions. And software is a giant blind. It's a way to hide, and it's a way to steal without having your identity revealed. And so the bad nature of people come out. And so we have to proactively work to prevent this. And so the larger world is a microcosm of the tech world, and the tech world is a microcosm of the larger world.
This is deep stuff, Alan.
Well, yeah, it is deep stuff. Look, the thing is so I use this metaphor all the time of Robert Oppenheimer, the guy who invented the atomic bomb in the 1940s. He was the smartest guy in the world, and the U.S. government gave him essentially unlimited power and unlimited resources, said invent the bomb to end the war. Okay, and he was on a mission of good, and he invented the bomb. And when he saw that bomb go off, he went, "Oh shit." Because all of a sudden he realized that while arguably he shortened the war, he also unleashed a new world order that was not necessarily a good thing for the human race. And that's exactly what's happened here in Silicon Valley in the last 20 years is we thought we were building, really cool ways to disintermediate retail. And it turns out that we were building the next atomic bomb, which is the thing is that what a lot of people in the United States don't understand is that the opening battles of World War III have already been fought. They were in your computer, on your social media, and the United States lost. So yeah, this is deep. Mm. This is big shit. And so interaction design is not about whether you get that big promotion. It's whether you're going to be in a gulag in 5 years.
Hmm. Yeah, I can't help but think about, King Solomon's words in Proverbs 30 verse 8. He said, give me neither poverty nor riches. Give me just the necessities of life. And I just feel like, there's a lot there, because I feel like when we just focus too much on money, we end up unleashing things that we probably shouldn't. And it's just really funny, not to get on too much of a tangent, but it's funny to see all these people who invented social media and invented a lot of the addictive tech that we have on an apology tour.
Yeah.
About it. It's funny to me, and it's like, well, yeah, you're laughing your way all to the, you're laughing all the way to the bank, while you made this stuff, and now you feel bad about it. But I just feel like there's got to be a balance. I think if there's any takeaway from me, defenders listening, keep fighting for the users, just like Alan has for 40 years nearly. And, you know, that is my, I mean, this show was inspired by Tron's words saying, I fight for the users. And we need champions. You know, it was, we need champions for the users more than ever. And, you know, and like Alan said earlier, you know, stand up and let your voice be heard. And if you don't get the empowerment, you know, at least you can wash your hands of it because you did do something. At least you brought up the issue. And if, you know what, and maybe if it's that big of a deal, especially if it's an ethical issue, get the Hades out of there and go and do something, build something yourself, make a difference.
Well, thank you. I agree. I appreciate your passion. And this is why I have arrived at this, at ancestry thinking. It's how do you be a good ancestor? You want to be a good ancestor. You know, there's an old joke, you know, that the way to be more successful in life is to choose better parents. And, you know, it's a joke. It's because it's true and because it's impossible. But it actually works the other way around, which is you can make your descendants more successful by being a better ancestor. And that is a choice that we have. So instead of making more money, you know, or being on the winning team, what we can do is we can be better ancestors. And here's, people think that what they have to do is, you know, they have a job working for Facebook and what they need to do is somehow change the organization, you know, or you know, where they come into work, you know, and their boss tells them to do something and they look at it and it's questionable and they think, gee, does that mean that I have to make a stand here and quit and throw a tantrum and say, I'm not going to do that? And to which
Jerry
McGuire. And to which I say, no, you don't have to do that because you hurling yourself into the machinery isn't going to accomplish anything. You know, you'll just lubricate the machinery with your guts. But,
right.
But what you can do is you can have an effect on the next generation of products that are coming down the pike. So the thing is that you can't divert the course of the Mississippi River, you know, where it's a mile wide, but you can go up to where it's a tiny little rivulet where it starts up in the Rocky Mountains, and you can divert the Mississippi with a shovel. And that's the kind of awareness that we need to bring to this. The idea that when somebody says, I've got an idea for something new we can do, what you can do is you can say, now, let's extrapolate. Let's say this is a success. What kind of toxic behavior are we putting into the embryonic product now that's going to manifest itself later? You see, and this is what I mean by ancestry thinking. These are practical methods for understanding how bad behavior creeps into products when they're tiny little babies. And you, as an individual practitioner, can detect these things and bring attention to them. And again, I don't expect you to make dramatic life or death stands and say, you know, this feature goes out of the product or I'm quitting. But I do expect you to bring to people's attention the fact that this feature or another, this mental model is in fact going to be a problem later. So bad ancestry creeps into products when we build them with assumptions. And everything gets built with assumptions, okay? That's like normal and okay. But the problem is that you make an assumption, what you have to do is you have to circle back and you have to assess that assumption. You say, did that assumption work? And if it didn't, you have to root it out. You can't let the assumptions float. The example that I like to use is it's a meme that's been going around the internet of a guy sticking his hand in a men's bathroom under an electric soap dispenser. And when he puts his hand under it, it puts a it detects his hand and it squirts soap in it. And then his buddy, who's black, sticks his hand underneath it, and the soap machine just doesn't recognize the black skin. Okay. Yeah. The assumption that the soap dispenser company made was that their staff was representative, that they were adequately representing their user community, okay? And that was a bad assumption, okay? It's not unreasonable to say, okay, we're gonna build our prototype based on testing with our staff. I've done it a million times, you know, it's okay.
Sure.
But you have to then recognize that that is an assumption you are making, and you can't let the product or the company continue with that assumption without questioning it. So questioning assumptions is an ongoing process. It's not something you do once and then move on. Okay, and this is something that we need to build in. It's like when I was a kid, when I was 10, 12 years old, when you ate a candy bar or drank a can of soda pop, you just rolled down the window of your car and tossed it out. Literally, that's how, I mean, if you watch Mad Men, there's a famous episode where they do that. And and kids today are, they just grow up trained to understand that they have to be conservative and they have to recycle and sustainability is drummed into them. Well, we can do that same thing with assumptions, is we can drum into people's heads that assumptions are not things that get left behind. They're things that get constantly re-examined. As situations change, even settled ones need to be re-examined. So there's another avenue for bad ancestry, and that's externalities. And again, externalities are normal and good. It's what you do is you say, I'm not going to worry about that. That's not my problem. It's somebody else's problem. And it's a completely reasonable thing to do. So if you're building a new office building downtown, the first thing they do is they put up those plywood barricades and they say, you know, civilians stay out. This is a hard hat area. That's an externality. What they're doing is they're saying, it's dangerous in here. Only trained and protected people can come in. We're keeping the public out. Okay, well, at a certain point, what they do is they say, okay, this externality has now served its purpose. And we're going to let the civilians in. But at that point, they have to know that it's no longer a dangerous place to walk. Okay, right. Well, it's the same thing with building products. Is when you create a product with externalities, what you're doing is you're saying, I don't have to worry about, you know, it's like Uber says, well, it's really easy. Just, you know, register your credit card with us and you can get in and out of a credit card, out of a taxi cab, an Uber car.
Sure. Yeah.
What they're doing is they're creating an externality. And the externality is that people who don't have credit cards are out of the system and can't benefit from it. Okay.
Right. True.
And the thing is that in fact might be a reasonable externality to make during launch time, okay? But it's not, what it does is discriminatory and destructive of the fabric of society over the long term if that externality is allowed to remain external. You can't do that, okay? Mm. And then the third—
Yeah, you can't rent a Redbox either without a credit card.
Yeah, there are tons of services that work that way.
And, sure.
Companies that don't take cash.
And
then the third thing is time scale. Time scale is what people do is they tend to look at things the way they are now instead of looking at things the way they're going to be in the future. And this is another vector for bad ancestry, how it creeps into products. And you constantly have to be saying to yourself, is this representative of the way things are going to be in the future? Mark Zuckerberg just a month or two ago was testifying in front of Congress. And he goes, we were blindsided by the power of Facebook. Okay, well, there's a word to describe that. That's called a lie. Because the thing is when you take venture money, you don't take venture money because you want to deliver a better product or a better experience. You take venture money because you want to grow. That's what you do, okay?
Right.
And when you take venture money, the VCs are on your board. And what they will do is they will force you to grow. You will get big. They love platform scale stuff. And that's one of the reasons why Facebook was such a VC darling. Okay. So the thing is if you get venture investment, which Zuckerberg did years ago, you are making a commitment. I mean, a serious till death do us part kind of commitment that you're going to grow. You're going to get as big as you possibly can, as fast as you possibly can. Okay. Yep. So when the CEO of the company says, we were surprised by getting big, that's a lie. Okay. What he did was he created an externality, and he did it by refusing to think about the time. Okay. By refusing to, and all the social media guys are the same. They all do the same thing. They go, social media is impartial and amoral and will police itself, when it's 5,000 of your best friends and early adopters and people who think like you in Silicon Valley, that's probably true. And when it's 500 million people in the vast world, it isn't true. It's just patently not true. And for anybody to stand there and say, well, it'll police itself, we've got 10 people, to police 500 million. That's just, right. That's a lie, and it's bullshit. So the thing is what you have to do is you can't, there are lots of people right now screaming at Jack Dorsey to throw Nazis off Twitter. Okay. Sure. And Jack Dorsey doesn't know what to do. He's in a terrible dilemma, the poor guy, because if he throws him off, he gets flack. And if he doesn't throw him off, he gets flack. So he doesn't do anything and he gets flack. Okay.
Yeah.
But the time to say something is when it's a tiny little embryonic product. When the company, when at a certain point, Jack Dorsey said, I don't have to create an infrastructure to keep Nazis off of Twitter because all the other Twitterers will do it. Okay. At that point, somebody needed to have said, maybe you shouldn't throw that Coke can out the window of the moving car. Maybe someday there will be lots of Coke cans out the windows of lots of cars and it will be accumulating and it will be really bad for our quality of life.
Yeah.
You see? Okay, so is that easy? No. Okay, does that mean that you're going to be telling truth to power and risking your job and your life? Yes. So what else are you doing? I mean, this is hard. It's really hard stuff. But all the time I hear people apologizing and saying, well, it's really hard for the business has to do this. The business doesn't have to do that. The business could be good. It could be really good. The thing is that there are some billionaires who are going to be making a few billion less, okay? But all the people who are actually working for a living, they're not going to be making any more or any less. What's a good metaphor? It's like integrating a giant university and saying you'll just have to deal with the discomfort of the formerly comfortable.
Yeah.
It's not okay. I mean, you have to come in and proactively defend the motion. I mean, this is why companies, look at a company like GE, huge company. Yeah. They had a giant commitment from the top down to have a design effort. Okay. And what happened was the people they brought in to, as practitioners were top of the top. They were the best of the best. But the people they brought in the executive level to give them air cover didn't really give them a lot of air cover. They didn't treat it as a tender little shoot in a garden of robust weeds. Instead they said, just fight like all the rest of the guys. And GE's great effort has been severely beaten up and broken by that. And you see this a lot of times in organizations. You certainly see that in Apple. You see the results of that.
design and build interactive prototypes, update artwork, and test your experiences, all without having to upload, sync, or jump back and forth between apps. Adobe XD is available for both Mac and PC and integrates with Adobe Creative Cloud libraries, meaning that no matter what your team configuration, XD has you covered. And now you can get Adobe XD for free. Just go to userdefenders.com/XD to learn more. Yeah, I want to shift gears, Alan. Because I'm so glad you talked about ancestry thinking, and the entire sentiment is just absolutely spot on, and it's inspiring. And I love the analogy too of, you know, how do you divert a large river? Well, you start at the source. You start at the beginning, and I love that. So I think that our defenders listening, and myself included, are really inspired by that. We can, like, we may be think we're little people, or we're, you know, we don't have a big title in our company or whatever, but we can be at the source of the river, and we can divert as long as we are keeping that ancestry thinking in mind. I dig that a lot.
Thank you.
So I appreciate you. Yeah, I absolutely appreciate that initiative, and defenders, check it out. I know right now your website, it's kind of a landing page right now, but you're probably working on something.
It is a landing page. So, what we did as a kind of a way to, I've been working with a young man named Renato Verdugo who lives in New York City. And we have been trying to refine our thinking on this. And we're very pleased with what we're come up with, but we're in order to kind of prove to ourselves that it was real, we have begun teaching this as a class at the University of California at Berkeley in the Jacobs Center for Design Innovation as under the wing of the engineering school. And we taught it last year as a fall semester class. And we're teaching it again this year, this fall also. And it's been really good discipline. You know what they say, to learn something, you teach it. And so it's been great discipline for us, and we don't know where it's going to go. I mean, as I said at the beginning, you know, the design, ancestry thinking lab is aspirational. What we're hoping is that some organization is going to say, this is a reasonable investment that would be good for the industry and for the company. And we'll hopefully subsidize this and keep us going, because right now it's mostly me speaking, and you know, being the lonely voice in the wilderness.
But defenders, keep tabs on it. Ancestrythinking.com. Yes, is that correct, Alan?
Yes, ancestrythinking.com. Thank you.
Yes, keep tabs on that. That's awesome. So I want to, as we kind of start wrapping up here, Alan, I have just a few more questions if you have time.
Sure.
I appreciate how generous you've been so far in your time. I guess this is one that I feel is interesting. As you know, this, and we all know, this field is complex and ever evolving. I feel like I've seen a lot in 20 years since the web. I know you've seen a lot in 40 years, mm-hmm. you know, since the invention of computers and software for, you know, which you were a big part of, frankly. So I want to ask you, you know, as we kind of start diving even more headlong into artificial intelligence, for better or worse, you know, it's obvious that a lot of inevitable disruption, as Kevin Kelly would put it, and change are in all of our futures. You know, what does the future of UX look like to you? I mean, should we be concerned about the robots we're inventing to destroy us one day? And what does design, even the field of design, look like to you, even in the immediate, if not distant future?
Well, I think that's a good question. I don't lay claim to be much of a prognosticator. I think that there's going to be a continuing battle between in the UX field, between those who think that their job is to be creative and put a pretty face on things, and those who think that their job is to to rethink the compact between users and technology. And I'm always fighting for the latter because I think that it we have to do that. I think that the worst products in the world can look beautiful. It can be really easy to click on the hurt myself button. And so I think you really have to look at the bigger picture of what are we actually doing here. And I see this battle going on in the UX world, and that's the only battle of significance. I know that there's battles for terminology and there's battles for tools, and I don't think any of those are significant. You know, I mean
job titles.
I don't think it's significant. I think what's significant is executive compensation. Okay.
Do explain.
Well, do executives get more money by making their users more successful, or do they get more money by making more money for the company? You know, it's really interesting. One of the discussions I have on Twitter all the time is designers who say, my job as a designer is to reconcile the goals of the company with the goals of the user. Mm-hmm. Okay, that just sounds so mom and apple pie.
Sounds like the Fuller Brush Man.
It's wrong. It's deeply and profoundly wrong. If the goals of the business are not completely coincident with the goals of the user, then there's something fundamentally wrong at the business side. And there always is. And it's always the same thing. It's the personal ambition of business executives. Okay? Because business executives do not get compensated for achieving the user's goals. They get compensated for there's a big truck going by. They get
no worries.
They get compensated for making money. Okay. And you know, as I said before, you can make money by burning the place to the ground. Okay. And in many cases, they do. Okay. So what we need to do is look. User experience professionals, interaction designers, what we do at the bottom is we understand who our users are, we understand what they want, what will make them happy, and then we figure out ways to deliver that to them. We find ways to make them happy. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what your business should be doing. And if your business isn't doing that, it's because there are conflicting reward systems elsewhere in the organization. So this is why executive compensation is a user experience issue. It's why I say that creating a good user experience is not as much a design problem as it is a power struggle. You see? So again, you can't walk into, you know, Facebook or Apple or Amazon or Google and say, we need to change the executive comp structure around here. Okay. But at your tiny little startup, what you can do is you can say, are we going to set up our comp structure around here so that people get a lot of money if they make a lot of money, or they get a lot of money if they make users happy?
Well said. And sadly, there's always going to be that. And I think we've seen, even just in the past 20 years, the corporate greed, the corporate scandal. I immediately thought of Enron, you know, and a lot of the stuff that even happened during the .com. There's just was that greed.
Please do not say there always will be, because that isn't true. Okay. When you say that, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Do not tell the young defenders that it would be good if we could all be altruistic, but it's never going to happen. So fuck it. Go, you know, get your pound of flesh while you can. Don't do that.
Thank you.
Okay. So fight this fight. Understand that there are a lot of battles that are going to get lost between here and there, because there are, you know. I'm not a fool, and I'm not, you know, living in a cloud cuckoo land. And I understand that I'm going to lose a lot of battles. But the fact is, you know, I came from the early days of the technology when people really did set out to make great products, and then they were kind of astonished by how much money they made. And the problem is that amount of money that they were astonished by attracted a lot of people who weren't astonished by it, but expected it. And so what I see when in the mid 70s in Silicon Valley, our driving force went like this: I'm going to create some really cool technology, and if I make a lot of money while I'm doing it, that's going to be cool. And what I see today is people coming into technology saying, I'm going to make a lot of money, and if I can make some cool technology while I'm doing it, that would be cool. And that's asked backwards. And the thing is the first way gets you good technology and money. The second way gets you money. Okay. But the thing is that earlier version of Silicon Valley is proof that we can do it again. So you can say, that's a hard battle to fight, Alan, but don't say there will always be.
Okay.
Okay. Because we can change this. You know, we can create a kind of society where what we do is we have metrics for looking at the quality of life instead of having metrics for looking at how many houses we burn down. We can do that. We can make that change.
Yeah. I love that. I appreciate you correcting my framing on that. That's and I love the passion, man. That's defenders. Absorb that. And let's all do this together. Let's figure that out.
Cool.
For sure. A couple more, Alan. Speaking of the defenders, which I love, I do this for them. A lot of them are younger, newer designers that are trying to navigate this field, trying to figure out the right path to go down. And I really especially like questions like this, because I think these questions like this really especially benefit their journey. And I call it a journey. I'm not afraid to call it a journey, because it really is. What do you want every aspiring UX superhero to know about this field that will help them succeed on their important design journey?
Thank you. That's a good question. That they nobody's going to give you permission. And that you are as powerful as you care to be. So if what you do is you say, can I do this? The answer is always going to be whatever you think. they're not going to say, sure, go try it. And what they're going to do is they're going to say, no, you can't do that. And you're going to have to fight. Okay.
Yeah.
But you have
what Henry Ford said, whether you can or you can't, you're right.
Exactly.
Whether you say you can or can't. Yeah,
exactly. And the thing is you have to understand that it's, it may not be a zero sum world, but pretty much all of the business people I've ever met act like it is. Okay. So the thing is that for you to get resources, for you, permission is a resource. Okay. You're going to have to essentially take a resource away from somebody else, or at least the perception of that. Okay.
Yeah.
And what matters in this world is what you do, not what it says on your resume. What matters is not your portfolio. What matters is what you do. And if there are a lot of organizations out there that are, what they're going to do is they're going to ask you to be something you're not and say things that you don't believe in, don't work for them. Make the right choice. If you're an interaction designer and you're skilled, then you're valuable. And there are more open recs for a person like you than there are people like you. You know, if you're a wannabe, you know, who used to be a yoga instructor, and now you want to get into the high paid field of tech, and so you discover that empathy will get you a job as a user experience professional. And so what you do is you only teach yoga on the weekend. I'm not slamming yoga instructors. I have high regard for yoga yogis, but empathy don't make you a UX designer. Okay. It's actually hard work, and it's a specialized skill that demands training and experience, okay? But if you've got that skill, if you've got that training and experience, then you are very valuable. And when people say to you, well, you're going to be, you know, a team of one working on designing our new hamburger menus, say, you know, I don't think so. I'd rather go rearrange my sock drawer. You gotta, just because somebody tells you you're a small person doesn't mean you have to believe it and act out being a small person.
Love that. Oh, that's so good. Such great advice, Defenders, from Alan. I'm going to sit in this moment for a second. this is my last question, Alan. This may be, out of all the value that you've just added, and you've dropped some nuclear proportion value bombs on us today, this might be the most valuable. What do you want your legacy to be? And you've been at this for probably longer than any of us can say. I mean, any of us can say that we have been at it, and you have certainly have already. Brought you already have a lot of legacy, and again, your bio, reading your bio is, you know, that's just a fraction of that. And I want to ask you, you know, from the bottom of your heart, you know, what do you want your legacy to be when you're no longer here and people think of you? What do you want them to remember most?
Well, I tried to be a good ancestor. You know, I spent so many years, you know, chasing after money and business and approval and recognition and personal pleasure and self-indulgence. I mean, I did it all. But you get to the point where you realize the things that you do that are significant are not really the things that you do today, but they're the things that you leave behind for other people. And having kids has a lot to do with that. You begin to think, you know, what is the world they're going to live in, you know? And I look at my son just bought a condo in LA, and it's 115 degrees there this week. And I'm going,
wow.
You know, that's my problem. And I can do something about that. And I have another son who lives in Denmark, and Denmark is one of the low countries. And I look at sea level rise and I go, boy, you know, I hope Scott's house is still there in a decade, you know, and not underwater. I know that the World Wide Web and social media are tools that have a direct effect on the climate. This is our game to lose. So being a good ancestor is not a nice to have. This is a life or death struggle. It's of greater importance than anything else you're doing. And again, I don't expect everybody to be Joan of Arc. I don't expect you to be out on the barricades sacrificing your life. But I do expect you to not say, that's not my problem, because that's creating an externality. And when you create an externality, you create a place where evil leaks into your life and into the things you make and do. So you constantly have to be saying, am I being a good ancestor? You know, and I'm sitting here drinking water out of a plastic bottle, you know, a one-use plastic bottle. And I'm going, oh my God, that's like a no-no, and I'm being really evil. But all I have to do is I have to say, this month, I'm going to drink one fewer bottle, plastic, disposable bottle of water than I did last month. And I'm working on being a better ancestor every day. And everybody,
start small.
Everybody can do that. This is what my wife taught me is you set achievable goals and then celebrate reaching them, and you will be a happy person. You'll be motivated to do it again tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Femke, and I'm a designer, writer, and podcaster, and I fight for the users. You're listening to User Defenders Podcast with Jason Ogle.
I like that a lot.
Thank you.
I like that a lot. Alan, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you,
Jason,
so much for doing this. I feel like I've been transported. I feel like I've been transported in my worldview, my perspective and my perception has really been altered in a good way.
You thought we were going to talk about personas, right?
And that's the one question I didn't ask you today. Isn't that interesting?
It's probably a good thing.
I was like, we just need to keep going down this road. This has been so rich, so incredible. I'd say by far really one of my deepest dives that I've ever had on the show.
Wow.
And I thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Alan, thank you for being the original user defender. and keep doing what you're doing. And last but not least, I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll see you. I spend most of my time on Twitter. I'm Mr. Alan Cooper. And I'd love to talk to more defenders.
Awesome. I'm so glad you mentioned that. Thank you.
Cool.
And we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jason. Bye-bye.
There are few in this industry who've achieved and contributed as much as Alan Cooper has to this incredible field. I was on the fence, to be honest with you, about reading his whole bio at the beginning of part one, as it's quite extensive, as I know you probably know that by now. But it felt necessary. And the reason I felt that it was necessary is to shed light on someone who has dedicated his entire life to fighting for the users, both current, even back then, and especially future ones. Yes, we can all be good ancestors, and frankly, we ought to be. Being a good ancestor means, to me at least, reflecting every decision we make in this arena with the mirror of good ancestry on the other side of it. We can't stop the river from flowing, but we can stand at the base of it and reroute the water in a direction that not only makes life better for our users, but makes them better. We, in turn, and future generations especially, will be better for it. Tweet those takeaways, defenders. I'm at User Defenders, and Alan is at Mr. Alan Cooper. Alan's never been one to not engage with a Twitter conversation, and certainly he's been known to start many. So I'm sure he would love to hear, and I know I would love to hear from you on what your takeaways were on this series, this part one and two of this interview with Alan Cooper. We'd love to engage with you on Twitter as well. Get on the Bi-Weekly Bugle, would you? Defenders, I've kind of changed some things since the new season started, and even before. I'm making it a little more simple, a little more just straightforward. I kind of took away some of the bells and whistles, some of the images and colors, and it feels more like a email from a friend, and that's really what my intention is. And thankfully, most of you have echoed that you really like that better. And you know what? Honestly, Defenders, it actually takes a lot of pressure off of me to send emails out to you and actually, you know, not take for granted those of you who have entrusted me with your email address. So it's great. I don't have to go through all the motions of kind of making a big formal email when I just want to say hello and, you know, tell you maybe something I learned. So I'm trying to kind of, you know, keep it real, so to speak. And so I hope you defenders that aren't on the Biweekly Bugle, you would check it out. You can do that by going to userdefenders.com/join. I'd love to connect and engage with you there. I'm just on the other side of the reply button. In 2 weeks, defenders, I have a really super special episode in store for you. This is one, it's called The State of UX in AI. And my friend, fellow defender, and repeat superhero on the show, Josh Clark, joins me. And man, this guy is a deep diver when it comes to this stuff. This is his wheelhouse. There's some really super interesting conversational pieces that come out of this and things that I think will spark a lot of ideas and thoughts about where we're heading in our technologies, and especially as it relates to machine learning and artificial intelligence. So be sure to subscribe, userdefenders.com/subscribe, to automatically receive this exciting episode coming up. So thanks so much, defenders, for being a part of this journey. You are why I do this. So yeah, and I'm always here for you. So until next time, as always, fight on, my friends.